A peaceful town is gripped by terror. The police are hunting a killer who preys on young women. The officers have only a vague description and few clues. He holds all the keys. Another murderer goes to great lengths to get rid of a corpse. Now anonymous, the victim prevents the detective from finding the perpetrator. It is in the hands of the dead woman that the means of bringing her justice will be found. One dark night, a dangerous bend on a lonely road, a woman is found dead at the bottom of a canyon. Her death seems accidental at first glance, but it could have been planned. As a general rule, humans do not kill unless they are certain of escaping conviction. Murderers are always convinced that they will outwit the police, but here they make a serious miscalculation. Late in the evening of Tuesday, November 23, 18-year-old Emmy Hoffman, mother and co-worker, reported to the Morris County Police Department. Emmy had not returned from the mall where she worked. She worked as a salesperson in a women's clothing store two nights a week. She was on the cheerleading squad and was saving money to become a chiropractor. Her co-worker said that Emmy had helped her close the store. It was around 9:30 p.m. and she was among the last to leave the mall. When Mrs. Hoffman saw that her daughter had not returned, she went to the mall to look for her. The only car in the parking lot was her daughter's. Her keys were in the ignition. Her purse, wallet, and wallet were on the seat of the vehicle. There was no sign of the young woman. Concerned that she was missing, her mother had called the salesperson who worked with Emmy. The two women were at a loss for what to do. The police went to the parking lot with a dog handler to try to find Emmy. But the dog lost track of her just a few meters from her car. Emmy appeared to have left the center with someone. But who? No clues were found in the parking lot. According to Maurice County Detective Sergeant John Kencom, there were no more in Emmy's car. We searched her vehicle as required by procedure. We looked for fingerprints or anything that would help us find her, but there was nothing. It wasn't gonna last long. Days later, on Thanksgiving Day, a walker in a secluded area of Morris County, New Jersey, made a disturbing discovery. It was the body of a young woman. He immediately alerted the police. Fisheries officers on the scene discovered the victim in what had once been a water tank. There was no doubt that it was Emmy Hoffman. She had been stabbed multiple times. Her body was collected and sent to the lab for analysis. The experts examined the scene for clues. There were bloodstains near the water tank. Subsequent analysis allowed the experts to determine that it was the victim's blood. The experts gathered all the evidence they had. Sometimes the most incriminating evidence is hidden in the most innocuous debris. The autopsy provided a little more information. The victim had been stabbed multiple times and had died of blood. She appeared to have been sexually assaulted, but there was no trace of semen. Fibers and fragments of foam padding were collected from her boots and clothing. So far, these were the only clues that showed any potential. To obtain more information, the police went to the mall to interview other employees. A woman said that when she left work around 9 p.m., she saw a suspicious-looking man sitting in his car, waiting. The vehicle was an old beat-up car. She only saw the man's face for a split second. She couldn't describe him. There was no time to waste. We knew there was a dangerous criminal on the loose in the city. A predator. What motivated me and all the investigators involved in this case the most was to stop this man before he killed again. Weeks after M. Hoffman's murder, a truck driver at a rest stop 20 minutes from the Morris County Mall was jolted awake. A terrified young woman was begging for help. She was bleeding profusely and badly injured. The truck driver called the police. D. O'Brien, 25, had lost a lot of blood, but was still conscious when paramedics arrived. She told police that less than a mile from her home, a man in his car forced her to pull over. Fearing that the other driver had been injured in an accident, she got out of her car to help him. The man then brandished a knife and forced her into his car, an old Chevra. He then drove her to a rest area where he raped her and stabbed her repeatedly. Drew O'Brien would unfortunately not survive his injuries. After describing her attacker, she died. The victim of the second homicide told police that the assailant was a white male, about the same height as her, and was wearing jeans and a Western-style shirt. The suspect and his vehicle matched the description of the suspect in the Hoffman case. Forensic scientists found only a few synthetic fibers on Drew O'Brien's clothing. They went to the scene to look for other evidence. They noticed a tire print in the dusty ground. It was photographed and then a cast was made. To preserve this tire print, forensic scientists used the same product used to make molds of teeth. This product sets quickly and is more durable than plaster. This print was just one potential clue, but so far it was the most important. We focused primarily on this tire print. Judging by its location, about 1.5 meters from the victim's car, it was probably the suspect's car. The cast and photographs of the print on the ground were sent to forensic scientist Pete McDonald. I consulted my tire print guide and discovered that there are about 20 different types of tires with similar prints. However, the closest match was Cyberland Snow Power. Detective Sergeant Kencom kept the photo of the print with him. He visited shopping malls, local businesses, and auto wreckers, but was unable to find a single tire similar to the one described by Pete McDonald. The killer had to be found quickly before he claimed a third victim. That's when the phone rang again and another person had been stabbed. Maurice County detectives in New Jose were investigating the murders of two young women. All signs pointed to a serial killer at work, but there were no suspects. They tried to speed up the search before there was another victim, but to no avail. This time, the victim was a man, but the details surrounding the crime were already familiar to the officers. James Kodetic, 34, said that while he was driving, an old Chevrolet forced him to stop. He could see a blue light flashing on the dashboard. The driver of the Chevrolet got out of his car and stabbed him. Kodati fought back. He managed to escape and get to his mother's house. His description of the stabbing sounded like the killer's. James Kodatiak was lucky. His injuries were not serious. Paramedics took him to the hospital. Before leaving, he allowed the police to search his car. The forensics team hoped to find evidence that would link this attack to the two murders. They vacuumed it. It was an old Chevrolet similar to the one described by witnesses to both homicides. A disturbing coincidence, to say the least. Detective Kencom decided to examine the vehicle's tires. I examined the right rear tire and determined that it was the tire we were looking for. I then opened my briefcase in which I had a copy of the tire sketch, as well as technical data such as thickness, size, etc. I measured the right rear tire of the vehicle and noted certain common characteristics. It was the same. James Kodati's vehicle was directly linked to the scene of the kidnapping of Dardre O'Brien, who had been murdered a few weeks earlier. The murderer's third victim had therefore become the prime suspect in this investigation. With this information, detectives were able to obtain an arrest warrant. Kodati was still in the hospital when he was arrested as a suspect in the murder of Dardre O'Brien. When questioned about the tire imprint he had left, the suspect admitted to making a sharp turn on that section of the highway, but added that it was not at the time of the murder. The police didn't believe him, but the evidence was unfortunately circumstantial. They had to find a way to strengthen the investigation. Furthermore, it wasn't just the murder of Dardre O'Brien that needed to be solved, but also that of Amy Hoffman. The answer wasn't far away. The fibers collected from inside Kodatik's car were compared to those collected from the two victims. Micro clues from the victims, such as fibers from their skirts, were discovered in his car. We also found fibers from the carpet of his vehicle and traces of foam padding from the seats on the victims themselves. The evidence was consistent. Despite the evidence against him, Kodatek maintained that he was not the murderer. His main argument was the injury he had sustained to his back. The investigators decided to examine this injury more closely. The severity and angle of the injury suggested that the suspect had inflicted it on himself.
Yeah.
But why did he go to all that trouble? We believe he thought the police were on his trail or that he was a suspect in the case, which was not the case. That would explain why he came up with this scenario. Kodati's plan had failed. Instead, he had put himself in the detective's sights. All the evidence suggests that Kodati preyed on vulnerable women, kidnapping them before raping and killing them. For the murders of Amy Hoffman and Dardre O'Brien, James Kodati was sentenced to 95 years in prison. The connection between Kodatek and his victims was not obvious because he struck at random. Most murders are not random in this way, and killers expend a great deal of energy trying to erase any connection between themselves and the victim. On May 8, 1993, at Lake Lou Eager Park, a young couple desperately called for help from a park ranger. Someone had set fire to a bush. Amidst the flames, the shape of a mannequin could be seen. At first, the couple thought it was a prank, but upon closer inspection, they realized that whoever had done it was not joking. It was a real corpse. After removing the body from the flames, they called the police. The officers could see that the victim was a woman, but that was all. She was missing her head. They pulled bags of melted garbage and a blackened cardboard box from the debris. Detective Mike Chile of the Illinois State Police was helping to search for clues.
We had state police dogs with us, and searched the entire area in an attempt to find the victim's head and any clues. Unfortunately, it was a waste of time.
The identity of the murderer and the victim was unknown. However, the police were convinced that once the victim's identity was known, they would find the killer. The crime was too gruesome to have been committed at random.
Anyone who would go to such lengths to burn a body and decapitate it did so to erase any trace of a link between himself and the victim.
For now, only the victim could provide a new lead. X-rays allowed the experts to discover that the victim had fibroids. They were large enough to have caused her health problems. The garbage bags were unremarkable. As for the cardboard box, it had come from a moving company. These clues were not very revealing. A forensic anthropologist was assigned to examine the victim's bones. By determining the victim's age, height, and skin color, this data could then be compared to that of missing persons. Forensic anthropologist Mark Jonesy of the Illinois Police Laboratory was assigned to this analysis. The pubic bone in the lower pelvic region gives us a good indication of age. The bone changes over time.
Given this, I was able to determine that she was between 35 and 39 years old.
Determining her race would be more difficult. Skin color changes at the time of death, and the fire had not made things any easier. Mark Jonesy had to rely on his experience and judgment to draw his conclusions. The pubic and axillary hair, that is, in the armpit, were straight. She appeared to have light skin. I therefore deduced that she was Caucasian. All that remained was to find out her name. The most effective way to identify an individual is through fingerprints. To do this, you have to take the victim's fingerprints and hope that they are already in the police database. Forensic scientist Gary Havey of the Illinois State Police was assigned to this task. The victim's hands were removed from the body, sealed in airtight containers, and sent to the lab. They had dried out and reverted to a deformed position. To obtain the prints, it would be necessary to first amputate each finger and attempt to rehydrate the skin.
In a case like this, to soften the tissue, I have discovered over the years that the best way to do this is to soak the fingers in a detergent solution.
This solution has the property of rehydrating the spirals, arcs, and loops at the fingertips. Precisely what is unique to each person. Once this operation was completed, Heavy rolled the fingers in ink and printed the convolutions on white paper. But he was not satisfied with the result.
I didn't want acceptable prints. I wanted to get the best possible prints. So we resorted to another method to obtain the details of the fingers and palms of the hands. Over the years, I found that I could get good results with black powder and frozen adhesive tape.
The operation was a success. The prints obtained were photographed and labeled. They would then be classified and sent to the Automated Fingerprint Identification Service in Joliet, Illinois, where prints from the entire state are classified. Only the prints from the victim's left thumb and index finger were clear enough to be entered into the computer. But generally, that's all this high-performance machine needs.
At the time of this investigation, there were 17 or 100,080 records in Joliet. It would have been impossible for me to examine all of these cards one by one. But with this computerized system, it can be done in a period of 30 minutes to 2 or 3 hours.
The results were negative. There were no identical prints. The victim and her killer still had no identity. The body of a murder victim had been discovered burning in an Illinois park, until forensics figured out who it was, the killer would be at large. Investigators needed to find a lead. They interviewed people who had been in the park the night the body was discovered. Two students out for a walk after their graduation ceremony said they had seen a fire. There was a minivan right next to it. They thought they recognized a Missouri license plate. The back door was open and they had seen garbage bags. It seemed likely that these students had seen the killer at work.
They parked their vehicle next to the suspect because they were worried that someone was going to start a fire in an area where it was illegal. When they saw them park, the suspect ran, jumped into his minivan, and sped away.
Meanwhile, other officers were reviewing the records of people who had been reported missing in the past 18 months. None of these people matched the Caucasian woman in her 30s, but one name stood out.
One name that kept coming up in our search was Lynn Machum Thomas of the St. Louis metropolitan area. We had seen her name on our list before and had contacted the St. Louis Missing Persons Unit. We had also spoken to someone in the homicide unit, but we eliminated that name because she was black.
Detectives had no other leads. They interviewed Shirley Machum, Lynn's mother. Like Lynn, she lived in Missouri, just 50 miles from the park in Louisville, where the victim was found. Charlie had reported her daughter missing the day before the body was found. According to her mother, she was not dark-skinned. Like the victim, Lee had fibroids and was under the care of a doctor. In fact, on the day she disappeared, her brother had dropped her off at the doctor's office and agreed to pick her up after her appointment. He had returned 10 minutes late. He had gone inside to check, but Lynn had already left. He thought she might have gotten tired of waiting, and he had decided to walk home. He had not bothered to do anything else. Later that evening, their mother, Shirley, received a call from Lynn's husband, Curtis Thomas, asking if she knew where her daughter was. He said she had gone out about 20 minutes earlier, and he had assumed she had gone to her mother's house. But Shirley told him she had not seen him all day. Shirley Machum knew that her son-in-law was a violent man, and she imagined the worst-case scenarios. The next day, she reported her daughter missing to the St. Louis Police Department. Detectives reviewed the case file. It said that St. Louis police officers had gone to Lynn's residence to question her husband, Curtis Thomas. The latter had stated that the night Lynn disappeared, she had told him she was leaving him. He did not approve of her leaving, and they had had an argument. The last time he had seen her, she had left the house on foot. At first, he thought she had run away without taking her belongings, but when he learned that she was not at her mother's house, he feared the worst. There were no victims or signs of a homicide in Thomas' residence. As a result, the investigation into Lynn's disappearance was dropped. But 2 years later, Illinois detectives believed that the body discovered in the park was that of Lynch Thomas. The time of her disappearance matched the time the body was found. Her condition was the same as that of the victim. Nitas Thomas, her husband, had now become the prime suspect. Investigators questioned Lee's mother, Shlee, again, this time to ask her about her daughter's work.
He told us that his daughter worked at the local bank. Because of her job, she had to be fingerprinted. So we went to the St. Louis Police Department and asked to see that particular file. Those files were not part of the database and had to be reviewed annually. We then compared the data to that of our victim.
The analysis was done. The victim was indeed Lynchum Thomas. To learn more about Curtie Thomas and his activities following Lynn's disappearance, detectives tracked down a former girlfriend he had been seeing after his wife left him. She said Curtis had said he thought the police were stupid for mistaking their victim's skin color. However, this was several weeks before she was identified as black. She also told them that Curtis had access to a minivan at work. The vehicle matched the description of the one seen in the park the night of the murders. Curtis's friend had become afraid of him and decided to leave him. His testimony, along with circumstantial evidence, led investigators to arrest Curtis Thomas in January 1995 on suspicion of murdering his wife nearly 2 years earlier. Police obtained a search warrant for his residence. The suspect claimed he did not know what had happened to his wife, but detectives discovered newspaper articles about the discovery of an unidentified body on Lynn Island. Curtis Thomas was a violent man. Detectives believe he refused to let his wife leave him. After killing Lynn Mathon Thomas, he kept her body in the basement of his home until he was able to borrow the minivan. To slow down detectives, he decapitated his victim and then transported her to an Illinois park where he burned her body. Curtis Thomas was found guilty. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Thomas tried to eliminate the link between the victim and himself. Other murderers use a strategy of eliminating traces of their crime. On September 14, 1985, a motorist on a remote road in Liuten pulled over to help a man in distress. David Moseman reported losing control of his pickup truck in Logan Canyon. The vehicle plunged into the river 280 feet below. His wife, Taya, was still at the bottom of the canyon. The motorist called for help. Moss was in shock, but her injuries were superficial. He told paramedics that his wife was conscious when he helped her out of the vehicle and onto the riverbank. He pleaded with them to save her. While David Moseman was being taken to the hospital, the rescue team went down into the canyon to search for his wife. About 30 feet from the vehicle, which was wedged between the rocks in the middle of the river, was the body of Tonia Moseman. Her face was submerged. She was dead. Investigators arrived at the hospital to interview the victim's husband. They asked the nurse if David was able to answer a few questions. She informed them that David's injuries were superficial and that the hospital had already released him. Moseman had told her that he had been thrown from the vehicle as it plunged into the ravine. He had been very lucky to have escaped unharmed. The detectives waited until the next day to get his detailed account of the accident. When asked about his marriage, David Moseman replied that his relationship with his wife was difficult. They had started divorce proceedings, but recently they had been trying to save their marriage. On the night of the accident, David had taken his wife to a restaurant. They had a pleasant evening. Just like before. After dinner, they had driven home. David Mosman had taken the same route dozens of times. He had taken his eyes off the road as he approached a curve.
All he could remember was his wife's handwriting. In shock, he had climbed down into the canyon. He then saw that Tanya had been partially ejected from the vehicle. He helped her out and climbed back up to get help. Patrol Officer Larry Forsgren of the UTA Police Department was working on the investigation. He said he left her on the bank and she seemed fine. He spoke to her and she was conscious. He also said she complained of pain in her head, but he didn't see any blood. So he left her there to climb up and get help. In the days following Tanya's death, accident reconstructionists analyzed the area where the vehicle plunged into the canyon. A small mark on the roadway indicated that the vehicle had been turned abruptly at a speed of 20 to 30 miles per hour. Cache County Police Sergeant George Becker, forensic pathologist, said that these facts did not support David Mosman's statements.
The vehicle was lifted as it plunged into the ravine. There was no way the driver could get out. To do so, the driver would have had to hold the door open and get out while the vehicle was still moving. That was absolutely impossible.
The analysis had raised new questions. The case deserves some more attention. In Utah, police were investigating the tragic death of Tanya Mosman. She was killed when the vehicle her husband was driving plunged about 275 feet to the bottom of a canyon. The events, as described by David Mosman, did not support the facts. Investigators performed an autopsy on his wife. She had water in her lungs. This meant she had drowned. A mark from her waist to her shoulders indicated that she had been wearing a seatbelt. She could not have been thrown through the rear window as her husband had claimed. The only other marks on her body were three very clear bruises on the back of her neck. The forensic team examined the vehicle to try to determine what could have caused her bruises. They also used rods soaked in a solution that turns blue in the presence of blood. There was no trace of it in the van, and no object could have caused her injuries. Detectives returned to the scene in the hope of obtaining more information. On the bank of the river, they discovered a piece of irrigation pipe. David Mosman was a teacher, but in his spare time, he installed irrigation systems. The pipe was sent to forensic scientist Kent Glanville of the Logan County Forensic Laboratory for further examination. Glanville superimposed the pipe on a life-size photograph of Tony's neck injuries. The pipe was a perfect match. However, Mosman had good reason to carry the pipe. And while it was unlikely, the pipe could have struck the victim as the van plunged into the ravine. Detectives questioned Mosman again to obtain more information from him about the egg-laying accident. Among other things, he was asked to draw a map of the road and indicate where he lost control of the vehicle. He was astonishingly accurate. Unlike most accident victims, he was convinced that this was where he plunged, and it was very close to the truth. This was rather odd because the accident had happened during the evening, and it was dark. To be so accurate, he would have had to be very familiar with the area. This gave me the impression that he knew in advance where the vehicle was going to plunge. Days after the accident, this impression was reinforced by a call from Terry, a friend of David Mosman. David Mosman told police that the marriage was broken and that David was constantly making jokes about how he was killing Tonya. Chief Prosecutor Jim Jenkins was following the investigation closely. David had told Terry that he did not want to pay for the divorce. He also did not want to risk losing custody of his two children, nor did he want to share his assets or the money he had accumulated. So David Mosman could have killed his wife. The police then went to interview Tonya's friends. They all knew that the Mosman marriage was broken. According to one of Tonya's friends, she had been terrified more than once by David's behavior. He was very violent at times. Most of the time, they argued about the custody of their two young children. She told the police officer that David had recently tried to force Tonya to sign a document he had drafted himself. The document stated that in the event of a divorce, she would have to give up custody of the children. He had even threatened to kill her if she refused to sign it. Despite his threats, Tonya had consulted a lawyer to begin divorce proceedings. Shortly after, David had suddenly become very nice to her again. Tonya had confided in her friend that she was looking forward to going to a restaurant with him. On the night of her death, she had sincerely hoped that he would be able to reconcile. The turn of events then seemed to have worked in David's favor. Investigators continued their investigation. They discovered that David had carried $10,000 in life insurance on his wife for several years. But just 9 months before her death, as their marriage was beginning to fall apart, he had taken out an additional $100,000 in life insurance in the event of his wife's death. So David had a motive. Furthermore, the circumstances surrounding Tonya's death were suspicious. But there was no denying, at least for now, that it was possible that it was just an accident. The detectives had to prove their case. David Mosman had claimed to have left his injured wife on the bank. However, she had been found in the middle of the river. The investigators called in forensic scientist Dave Tallis to see if this was possible.
The deputy sheriff wanted me to examine the situation and determine whether it was possible, given her condition, for the victim to have crossed the distance between the bank where the husband said he had left her and the place where she was found.
Talis measured the depth of the river, the speed and direction of the current, to see if a human body could have been carried from the bank to the location where Tonya had been found. Was shallow near the bank and would not allow a body to float. Furthermore, even if it had been possible, the speed and direction of the current would have moved her along the bank and not toward the middle of the river.
If she was unconscious, she couldn't move and the current wasn't strong enough to move her. So we would have found her at the edge of the river, unconscious or drowned.
She had never been brought to shore, as her husband had claimed. David Mosman was arrested for the murder of his wife. Investigators believe that he tried to kill Tonya in a premeditated accident.
Yeah.
He caved. However, Tonya did not die instantly. He had to go down to the bottom of the canyon to finish his job. Apparently, the motives for his murder were his hatred for his wife, custody of their children, and the life insurance money. For his crime, David Mosman was sentenced to life in prison. Prisons are full of people who are convinced they committed the perfect crime. But when the victim stops breathing, the killer is not done yet. For investigators, this is just the beginning. They call on forensic scientists to ensure that the victims are served justice and that the murderer's mistakes are exposed.